This is the Context Podcast. Context Magazine is a publication of the American Sociological Association.
In this episode, we are joined by Amy C. Steinbugler. Amy is in the Sociology Department at Dickinson College. She is the author of Beyond Loving, Intimate Race Work in Lesbian, Gay, and Straight Interracial Relationships. We discuss her recent article, Racial Divides, which appears in the spring 2014 issue of Context Magazine.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi.
So, to start, what do you think sociologists can learn from studying the lives of interracial couples?
Well, I think that for people that study race and ethnicity, interracial couples have always been or have long been seen kind of as a micro-level barometer of macro-level race relations. And what I mean by that is I think that we've looked at these couples, we've looked at interpersonal relationships between blacks and whites with the idea that they can tell us something meaningful about the kind of broader relationships between whites and blacks as a group. And I think that's an important insight. I think it comes from, it's kind of strongly associated with the whole classic assimilation model that sees intermarriage as a crucial step in the assimilation of ethnic groups into a kind of broader white society. And I think that this this insight has been strong, even though the assimilation model has never really been a very good lens for looking at the experiences of African Americans. I think also we can look at, you know, we can look at interracial intimacy and interracial marriage and see that that marriage was really one of the very last institutions to be desegregated. So in 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education eliminates segregation in schools, and then a little bit later in 1964, the Civil Rights Act eliminates segregation in public accommodations. But it's not until 1967 that the Supreme Court finally strikes down those remaining laws, state laws against intermarriage. So I do think that given the kind of racial history, the kind of current moment of racial stratification that we live in, the really large-scale divisions of racial groups, that there's something meaningful to be learned by looking at people who navigate these divisions in everyday life and form families across the color line.
So in your book, you say that you want to open up a wider lens on how sociologists study these couples. What do you mean by that?
Well, I kind of mean two things by that. So when I talk about opening a wider lens, to me that means looking at a wider spectrum of couples. And it also means at looking at interracial couples differently. So let me say both parts of that. What this book does that I think is important in terms of opening up a wider spectrum is to include the experiences of gay and lesbian couples. There have been very, very, very few studies on lesbian and gay interraciality. And it's a problem. You know, it's a problem in part because in the absence of these gay and lesbian narratives, what happens is that the experiences of heterosexual couples come to stand in for everybody. And this has led researchers to make what I see as erroneous assumptions. So assuming, let's say, that racial difference is sort of the master status, if we could say, for all couples, mm-hmm. that racial difference is the most kind of defining thing about their relationship. Or it might lead, you know, it's led researchers, I think, to assume that interracial couples are almost always hyper-visible. But that's not true. But it seems true if we only look at the lives of heterosexual couples. And then I think kind of on top of that is that, you know, all these scholars for decades and decades have been looking and kind of normalizing the experiences of heterosexual couples, but they haven't kind of problematized heterosexuality itself. So they haven't looked at the lives and families of these couples and thought, well, what about all of this has to do with their heterosexual status? So I think that's important. So I want to kind of include more people in this analysis and, you know, kind of, bring back some of this work from these strong heterosexual presumptions. The other part is just to look at, I want to look at interracial intimacy differently. So I want to try to understand how these relationships work and how people establish, you know, intimate relationships in a racially stratified society, because I think it's important. I think that too often what happens, maybe this might be less by scholars, but more kind of in mainstream discourse, is that, well, also by scholars, is that people assume that people in interracial relationships have somehow gotten beyond race, that maybe they're racial mavericks or that race doesn't matter anymore. But I think that it just seems to me to be a kind of clearly a faulty assumption. I mean, feminists and other family scholars have looked inside heterosexual marriages to see how gender works. You know, there's no illusion that just because a man and a woman love each other or get married, that somehow all these like gender roles, gendered expectations, gendered patterns, that they somehow fall away. And so that work has been really important, understanding how gender works in families, right, in this institution of families. And I really think we need much more work that considers how race looks, how race works in families and in institutions and, you know, and in relationships. I think we can't just assume that because people love each other that race somehow fades away.
As most of the previous research focused on couples that are made up of black and white people, or has there been attention to many different types of relationships?
You mean, has there been attention to other kinds of racial, like, mixtures?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, and I would say that, you know, it's important to study black-white couples, in part because the racial line between whites and blacks has been the kind of most violently, intensely policed than any other kind of color line in the in U.S. history. So there's that. However, there's all other kinds of racial, you know, of interracial relationships. And so while research on those kinds of relationships has been, there's been much less of it. There's more and more, and it's, you know, clearly also important work to be done. And I should say, Kyle, that, you know, when I'm talking today, I'm sort of using interracial and black-white simultaneously because that's how it was in my study. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are important questions to think about when the experiences of black-white couples represent broadly maybe the experiences of some other mixes like Asian white or Asian black or, you know, Latino Asian, etc. But there are particular moments in which the black white experience is going to be unique. So that's useful to know. Mm-hmm.
So in the article that you wrote, you identified that some studies and also popular culture show that the acceptance of interracial couples has increased dramatically and people are generally pretty positive. But you seem skeptical about this. I'm curious why you're skeptical.
Yeah, well, I am skeptical. I mean, in the piece, I talk about this 2012 Pew study. It's called The Rise of Intermarriage. You can find it easily on the internet. You know, it makes some, you know, kind of striking points, I would say. So, for instance, it reports evidence from social surveys. So it says that over 40% of Americans now view interracial marriage as a change for the better. Or just over 60% say that they would be fine if a family member married out. And, you know, people look at studies like this, and I think that they see evidence that America is moving beyond race and moving beyond racism. And, you know, I think, you know, these statistics are interesting, and I wouldn't go so far as to say that they're meaningless, but I think that they're, you said skeptical. I do think there's a good reason to be skeptical. I mean, I think that people who study people who do work in survey research know that there's something we call the social desirability effect. And it's just a way that when people are being interviewed, they want to look like what they think is a good person. You know, they want to give an answer that either pleases the interviewer or kind of, you know, paints them in the best possible light. So I do think when you add up all the, you know, like all these individuals kind of trying to, you know, be socially desirable or acceptable, the kind of aggregate effect of that is you get a view of racial attitudes that is maybe softer or more optimistic than racial attitudes actually are. And then I think the other reason I'm hesitant and cautious about looking at these kinds of statistics and using them as evidence, you know, for the breakdown of racial barriers or divisions or whatever, is that there are clearly so many other ways that social and spatial divisions between races, not just blacks and whites, but Latinos and Hispanics are still very much alive. So we could look at, you know, I talk about in the article about racial segregation, you know, on the whole across the country, it's kind of like creeping down. But in cities like northeastern cities like New York and Newark and Philadelphia are among some of the most segregated cities in the country. So for instance, in New York City, the racial composition, I say this in the article, the racial composition of neighborhoods is so lopsided that 79% of African Americans in New York would have to move in order to have a kind of even spread of African Americans across the city.
Wow.
That's an intense amount of segregation. Or if we look at, you know, there's all this data about housing preferences, about what's people's ideal neighborhoods. And this research shows that whites are willing to live in neighborhoods that are maybe up to 20% black, but not much above that. So when I hear these Pew statistics, they're interesting, you know, but I think we have to weigh them against, you know, against what we know about surveys and the social desirability kind of effects, and also what we know about the depth and persistence of these racial divisions, you know, even now in 2014.
Yeah, it's really striking how so white people will say that they're willing to marry someone of a different race, but they don't want to live in a neighborhood that's predominantly that race.
It is striking. It makes you wonder on many levels what's really lies beneath that. You know?
So in the article you discussed, you went through some of the challenges that interracial couples do experience still. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and give some examples of some of those challenges?
Yeah. Well, in the article, I tried to make the point that the opposition and antagonism towards interracial relationships has, on the whole, become much more nuanced and much more subtle. And I say, and I believe this is true, many other people would say this, that it really mirrors the way that racism itself has changed. So there's a lot of good work on, you know, documenting the ways that we really have moved from a kind of overt, old school Jim Crow racism to a much more subtle, colorblind racism. Ta-Nehisi Coates just wrote a beautiful essay talking about the ways that our new racism is both elegant and monstrous, right? We are really in this kind of new moment, and you can see it in how people treat interracial couples. The thing I'll just say at the same time is that this transition is sort of, it's not seamless. So we still have these pockets of the past living in the present. You know, ways that old fears and stereotypes still linger. And just let, for instance, an example of that, I don't know if you saw, I think it was last year, 2012, this Cheerios ad. The ad is called Just Checking.
Yeah, I remember that.
Right? Mm-hmm. Seen on the internet. Cute little mixed kid, little girl, with her black dad and her white mom and this, you know, whatever. It's nice and it's about Cheerios and it lasts about 30 seconds. But when General Mills posted that on YouTube, there were so many of these kind of really hostile, vitriolic comments that they disabled the comments section and they just took, you know, almost took the whole thing down. So there are, you know what I mean? So I think that part of understanding what it means to be interracial now is to think that interracial intimacy really does kind of occupy this particular curious cultural state where you know, we're at once in this moment, this kind of colorblind moment where interracial intimacy can be seen as progressive or transgressive or innovative or whatever you want to say. And yet at the same moment, these old school, you know, vestiges of racism still remain. So in this moment with the old school racism and the kind of new school racism, couples still, you know, feel the effects of living in a racially stratified society. So, you know, I just mentioned residential segregation. That presents particular challenges. I mean, in the article, I talk about this idea of racial fatigue, right? About the ways that it's difficult to be one of the only people or a very small minority of people of your racial group in your neighborhood. Some of the couples that I interviewed really put a lot of time and energy into trying to find mixed neighborhoods to live in. So, you know, some went on the internet and looked at census data. Others drove around these, you know, the blocks of this neighborhood they're thinking of looking at, you know, of moving into, and they sit in their cars and they see who's around, or they go you know, was one, this black woman told me she went into an Irish bar in this neighborhood she was thinking of moving into because she thought, you know, this is going to be the bastion of intolerance. You know, like what are these, you know, what is this space going to be like? So couples really put, you know, did put a lot of thought, some of them put quite a bit of thought and effort and energy into try to navigate these segregated neighborhoods. And some people found mixed neighborhoods, but a lot didn't. So about 2/3 of the couples that I talked to lived in neighborhoods that were either 70% white or 70% black. So this idea of a kind of racial fatigue around neighborhoods is something that a lot of them dealt with. And then the other thing, that, another kind of sphere where race still matters and presents particular challenges for couples is in kind of explaining their racial perspective or orientation to their partner. So, you know, we, being a part of a racial group, we kind of go through our whole lives in the body that, you know, in this particular body. So we learn to see race, see racism, how it matters, how it doesn't, from a particular vantage point. And so in interracial relationships, I really do see there's sometimes this struggle or this conflict to explain what seems so natural and common sense to you, how to explain that to the other partner. So if like a story about that or a way to kind of tell you, explain what I mean about that, you know, in the book, there's this story I tell of this middle-aged couple. They live a few blocks from downtown in Philly. He's black and she's white. And they were walking along the edge of the Schuylkill River, a big river that kind of divides Philadelphia from West Philly. And they were in an area where there was a lot of construction. And so they're walking along the river and there's a guy, like a construction security guy, like a guy in a, you know, in one of the big, keeping track of the big machinery or whatever. And he sees them and he makes eye contact with the woman, with the white woman, and gives her what they both explained to me separately, kind of like, are you okay look. And she looks back at him and, you know, and maybe smiles or says hello. And then the moment's over, they walk past, it's, you know, onto something else and whatever. But, you know, as in the next days and the next weeks, he was really upset about that moment. You know, he was thinking about the ways that that security guard saw them together and immediately thought that he was, you know, a danger to her, right? Yes. That he was dangerous or somehow criminal to her. And they're, you know, they're partners. They're not married, but they're, you know, they're best friends, right? And then in that moment, she maybe reads the same thing and she signals to the guard. She also knows what's happening and she signals to the guard that, no, don't worry, it's okay. So, you know, in the days and weeks that follow, it's an issue. You know, they don't talk about it for a while, but it's an issue because he's really very angry that this thing happened. And she notices it, but she doesn't want to talk about it. You know, she feels like it's over or, you know, this happened, whatever. So there, and eventually they talk about it. And then maybe if they didn't talk about it, it might have been a kind of major, you know, like a kind of a major situation in their relationship. But there are these kinds of moments where deciding about how and whether to talk about race and racism and explain your own perspective and, you know, try not to get angry or try to be neutral or try to explain it in ways that your partner can understand. This kind of situation in a lot of, you know, other small kind of ways, that's just one example, is something that comes up for interracial partners. And I think that's a substantial challenge of interracial intimacy.
You had another powerful example of that in the article, I remember, where it was, there was a story about a couple that was helping friends move, and it was a question of one person, the person didn't have an ID, and it was a question of whether it was safe to drive the friend's car without an ID for fear of being pulled over by the cops.
Yeah.
And it really pointed out how it's so small, like those everyday things that you don't think about when you're talking about larger issues of race that really come up in these relationships.
Yeah, it seems so natural and obvious that you almost don't even think to explain it, you know what I mean? Or to have a language to kind of, because where do you start? You know, so like in that example you talk about, Scott's like trying to, you know, like explain to Tamara why he, you know, why he's not going to be comfortable in this car because, you know, in a friend's car in case something happens. But it's, so it's about that moment, and it's about racially, you know, being racially profiled. But it's a much, you know, it's a much broader history of the ways that, as you know, being a black male, a 20-something black male in the city and, you know, in America, he's kind of constantly thinking about these things, and she never has to. So, you know, it's specific, but it also is, there's a kind of a broad and deep history beneath it, I would say.
So one of the contributions you made to previous studies was that you paid attention to same-sex relationships. And I was wondering, how did sexuality play into this story? Or did gay and lesbian couples experience different challenges than the straight couples?
Yeah, it's an important question. And it was one of the major questions that I struggled with in the book. When it comes to the everyday lives of black-white couples, sexuality matters quite a bit in some contexts, and it matters much less in others. So the places where it matters the most are situations in which stigma or stereotypes come into play. And so often this is in public spaces. So one way to think of this is, so heterosexual black-white relationships, and this is especially true with black men and white women, are really quite visible in public, you know, in public, on sidewalks and in restaurants and in churches and at the mall and so on. And, you know, we can think part of this might be because they're unusual, relatively unusual, but it's also because this image, this kind of the specter of black man with a white woman, is a very, very powerful historical image, and it has been used by whites to strike fear in the hearts of other whites for a very, very long time, since right after the Civil War, you know, used to justify the rape and lynch, the lynching and sometimes castration of black men through the 50s, you know, the "would you want your daughter to marry one" was a kind of theme around, you know, convincing white Southerners not to integrate schools, right through to our current moment. So this is a particular, a very kind of powerful image. Black men with white women get noticed. They feel themselves to be noticed. The other kind of heterosexual pair, white men and black women, also has its own history of racial fear and violence, but it's taken up less cultural space, I would say, at least in, you know, for whites, less so with blacks. And so part of this history, part of the effect of this history and the ways this image is so powerful is that heterosexual interracial couples have really been maligned, you know, as dysfunctional or low class, or, you know, a kind of a union for two people who are really just exoticizing each other and using each other for sex. So I say that to say that people, so my straight partners, they felt noticed in public. You know, they felt the weight of others' gaze. And sometimes it was just a gaze or a stare or a hard look. And sometimes it was more than that, you know, like a couple walking in Brooklyn, you know, related experience where this guy threw water on them and kind of yelled at them. And, you know, and then, as I said before, mostly their experiences in public are a kind of subtle disapproval. Again, right? It's not like this old. It's much more unusual to have overt violence. But lesbian and gay couples in public draw much less attention for being racially different. So instead of the kind of hyper visibility that heterosexual couples face in public, they face really a profound invisibility. So they often feel like unless they're physically touching each other, people don't notice they're together at all. So one couple explained being at the beach in Jersey, I think, and, you know, having people look at them funny. Someone asked if, you know, this asked a black woman if her white partner was her brother or whether she was babysitting or all kinds of like weird configurations that people put in there. You know, put together in their mind, because the notion that, you know, that this is intimacy or a relationship is just not seen, right? It's not something that people visualize. Or another woman in Brooklyn told me about all these times that, you know, men come up and hit on her right in front of her partner while they're, you know, on the street walking together. So people's experiences in public, with all, you know, all manners of reaction, often negative, and somewhat subtle, their sexuality really does make a difference, because same-sex couples just don't have this kind of historic image that that follows them around. They're a bit harder to see. The place where it matters less is inside the relationship. So those examples that we were just talking about, we talked about Scott and Tamara and borrowing the car, mm-hmm. or the couple along the Schuylkill walking and the security cop. Those are actually situations where sexuality tends to matter much less. And to my mind, it's because what's at play, what's more at play is their status differences, their kind mm-hmm. of racialized status differences, the power or privilege that associated with their racial group or their racial position. So in places where the situation is around status differences, sexuality plays less of a role. But in situations that have where their racial difference is a matter of stigma or stereotype, then gay and lesbian couples have differences that have experiences that are quite different from straight couples.
So we've talked a good amount about some of the challenges that couples face or the negative experiences that they have. And I'm wondering if there's ever positive responses to being an interracial relationship. And something that you mentioned before we did this interview was Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York, who really seems to view his interracial relationship as a sign of pride and something that he celebrates or brings up often. So interracial couples ever receive positive responses?
Yeah, they sometimes do. I mean, one guy, the white husband of the woman who sat in the Irish bar feeling it out, says to me that he was kind of complaining, actually. I mean, he kind of felt like it was really annoying in a different way. But, of all these, I think he said they were white, like these earnest white people that would come up to them on the street and, say things like, "We think what you are doing is so important," right? They're really this kind of moment where this kind of colorblind, you can't see me, but I'm putting my quotes around this, right? Mm-hmm. Like colorblind moment where racial, where interracial intimacy is, kind of transgressive and it's new and it's like forward thinking and stuff. That's real. Like it does exist and it comes up sometimes. So mm-hmm. sometimes couples feel, get attention that is positive. That happens. Mm-hmm. I think that de Blasio situation is very interesting because here is someone who is kind of using his interracial family as a symbolic resource, in this mayoral race. And in that situation, I think probably for him, de Blasio was making kind of a deliberate calculation, but he was, trying to, I think, probably appeal to progressives who yeah. see interracial intimacy as, as forward thinking and progressive. And he's also trying to establish trust with Black and Latino communities. And this is, through the stop and frisk stuff and the ad that his son make. And maybe, he felt that he could afford to alienate some of the kind of hardcore bigots, which we know are still around, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it is a kind of interesting moment to look at how interracial intimacy can be used as an asset, which is certainly has not historically been the case. I mean, the one further thing to add to that is that the fact that Bill de Blasio is white and heterosexual and male mm-hmm. is an important part of this. I mean, I think it would be harder to imagine a Black mayoral candidate holding up his white wife and, mixed kids and thinking that this is going to help him get elected. I just think that historically, white men, especially of upper, classes, white heterosexual men have had the most license to choose sexual partners, whoever, across, from different racial groups to white men to have Black partners or to have sexual relationships with Black women, and that they're kind of, combined, the combination of their privileged statuses has often shielded them from social and political repercussions. So not anyone could do that. Bill de Blasio was particularly positioned given his social position, to do that. But I think it's interesting to see someone use their interracial family as a political asset and to, you know, think about what that means.
Did you ever see that acting as a challenge to relationships? Because it seems like it could get potentially annoying to see the white member of the relationship being held up as some sort of savior, being very forward-thinking for being in a relationship with you.
Yeah. You know, I think the same thing. I mean, I didn't have, some white partners were very conscious of it. Like, you know, that, you know, some people felt like they got extra props in like activist communities for having a black partner, you know, not saying that they wanted them, but that, you know, they were, you know, cool, or they were, you know, they were down or whatever. Mm-hmm. I didn't talk to black partners as much about what they thought of that, but it's funny. You can imagine that could get irritating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we began this interview by talking about what sociologists can learn about race from studying interracial relationships. So I'm wondering if we could finish the interview by asking what you've learned from doing this research project, or if there's anything that surprised you, or something that really was, that you really learned or was emphasized by being involved in this study.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, it was interesting to think so hard about the ways, or to kind of, in the end, come away with the idea that intimacy is really, it's not a raceless space, you know. There's not, intimate relationships are not somehow free from the larger context that they operate in. And it's, you know, it's useful, you know. I guess it's like, if racism were just a set of ideas, if it were just a set of stubborn prejudices, then you can imagine that interracial couples would be people that have, you know, unlearned those ideas, or didn't have them, or got around them, and then they really are these kind of racial progressives. But if you know, when you think about the ways that race is a social system, you know, and works through institutions, and that people, you know, are privileged or disadvantaged, you know, by their racial group, then it becomes much more difficult to think of how race would disappear inside the relationship. So, you know, thinking about how these social forces matter, even in our most intimate relationships, has been important to me. It's been something that I've come, you know, away with this, taken from this. And then I thought, you know, some of the ways that gender and sexuality work into these relationships was important and surprising to me, you know. So, you know, in the end, I guess I think it's important to study gays and lesbians, not just because they're full humans like everybody else, you know, but that really gives us an interesting way to look at what it means to be racially different, you know. So, like, away from the stereotypes and the history of violence and so on, the cultural tensions, to look, to think about what it means to be interracial at this particular moment.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop. Thank you for joining us. It was great talking to you today.
Oh, it was fun, Kyle. Thank you. This is